Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 33, verses 1 through 20. I will cover today, and we're going to see Jacob meeting his long-lost estranged brother Esau. Our context is this. In chapter 32, verses 1 through 21, Jacob prepared to beat Esau. And then in verses 22 to 32, as Jacob gets ready to meet his brother, he meets the angel of the Lord at the edge of the river Jabbok on the way, and he wrestles with the angel of the Lord, who I'm assuming is Jesus. He wrestles him for a blessing. He got the blessing, but only after he was wounded in his hip, in his flesh. And now Jacob is prepared to meet Esau, and we'll see this here in chapter 33. We start with verses 1, 2, and 3. Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. I'm assuming now that Jacob is at Mahanaim, which is two camps. That's how that word is translated, which is very near Peniel, where Jacob wrestled with the angel of the Lord. It's on the Jabbok River within, I say, 10 miles of the Jordan River, shouting distance. So that's where he is when he looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him, with Esau. So he, that's Jacob, divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. The two maids were Bilhah and Zilpah. He put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. Esau is showing up with 400 men. Now, there's no proof that these 400 men were coming with hostile intention, as Adam Clark said, but Jacob certainly felt like they were coming with hostile intention. In our last chapter, verses 6 and 7, Genesis 32, we read this. The messengers returned to Jacob. That's the messengers that Jacob had sent on down to Esau. The messengers came back and said, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds and the camels into two companies. That was so that if Esau attacked one company, the other company would survive. So Jacob fears these 400 people, even though they were, in my opinion, and Adam Clark's opinion, probably not coming with hostile intention. If they were, I don't think they would have been reconciled so quickly, Jacob and Esau, as we'll see later on, they were. Now, how were the children and the wives and the maids divided? There's a couple of options. One, Jacob could have made four divisions. He could have put Leah and her children in one division. Leah's children were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. That would be one division. Rachel and her son Joseph would be the second division. And then Bilhah, one of the Rachel's maid, and her children, Dan and Naphtali, and then the fourth division would be Zilpah and her sons, Gad and Asher. Or Jacob could have divided in this way. Could have put the maids together and their children, which would be Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, along with the maids, Bilhah and Zilpah, and then Leah's children, and Leah and her children, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, and then Rachel and her child, Joseph. However they were divided, we see that the maids were put in the very front. Now, why is that? Well, John Gill points out that the very front is the least honorable position of all the positions there. The most honorable position was in the rear where Rachel and Joseph were. Now, these Eastern cultures are big on honor. I remember living in China. If you sat in the front, in the rear seat of a taxi on the right side, that's where I always sat. Found out later because that was the position of honor in a taxi, and I was a foreigner, and they wanted to honor me. Likewise, you go into a restaurant, into a dining room in the restaurant, and you always sat at 12 o'clock high as you entered into the door. The foreigner did, the person they wanted to give the most honor. I always sat there, and it didn't occur to me for years why I was sitting in the same place, because they wanted to give me honor. Well, likewise, this doesn't surprise me that Gill is right when he says that Rachel and Joseph were in the most honorable position. It doesn't surprise me that there was a most honorable position. Now, not only might honor be considered here, but also safety. The NIV Study Bible and John Gill and Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown all say that Jacob wanted to keep his favorite wife and child the furthest away from potential harm. His favorite wife, of course, being Rachel, and his favorite child being Joseph. Once again, I don't think it's good to favor wives if you happen to have more than one wife. I hope you don't in this day and age, but if you do, you need to treat them equally. And if you have children, you need to treat them equally and don't favor one over another. It leads to nothing but trouble. But anyway, Jacob did favor Rachel and Joseph. He put them in the rear to keep them safe because that was the furthest away they could be from Esau. There's another option, as Adam Clark said, they will put last in the back because the choicest treasure is always exhibited last. This will make a bigger impression on Esau's mind when he finally shows up and he sees the beautiful Rachel there with her young child. Well, for whatever reason, that's the way the maids and the children were deployed. Now, once he laid them out that way, then Jacob went from the rear to the front to meet Jacob. The front was the position of greatest danger. Jacob was going to try and protect and defend his wives and children in the best manner possible. And as he went toward Esau, he kept on bowing as he walked toward Esau. He bowed 7 times. Now, he kept bowing until he got very close to Esau. Now, Adam Clark describes what the Eastern custom was about bowing, and we'll see about bowing, and we'll see how it worked here. Quote, "The manner of doing this is by looking towards a superior and bowing with the upper part of the body brought parallel to the ground, then advancing a few steps and bowing again, and repeating his obeisance till, at the 7th time, the suppliant stands in the immediate presence of his superior." So in other words, you figure out how far you got to go between you and your superior, and you pace yourself so that you bow 7 times so that the 7th time ends up right when you're standing in front of the superior. The members of his, that's Jacob's family, did the same. They were bowing and scraping. Well, maybe not scraping. They were bowing the same way that Jacob was doing. This was a token of profound respect, and though very marked, it would appear natural, for Esau, being the elder brother, was, according to the custom of the East, entitled to respectful treatment from his younger brother. His attendants would be struck by it, and according to Eastern habits, would magnify it in the hearing of their master. 7 is not only the customary way of bowing in the East, it was also a sign of absolute submission, because as we know, 7 is the number that means divine perfection. We go to verse 4, Genesis 33. "Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept." Now, it's an interesting point here that Adam Clark makes about this word embraced. Esau embraced Jacob. Embraced. Quote, "In the Masoretic Bibles, each letter of this word is noted with a point over it to make it emphatic. And by this kind of notation, the rabbis wish to draw the attention of the reader to the change that has taken place, that had taken place in Esau, and the sincerity with which he received his brother Jacob." Now, we can only speculate as to the natural reason for this change in attitude of Esau. Here's 4 options. Option 1, it could have just been Esau's impulsive nature. He was upset with Jacob and wanted to kill him before, but that was a long time ago. That was just an impulse. Now, I'm happy with him. That's John Gill's speculation. It could be Esau. Option 2, that Esau was impressed by all of Jacob's presents. Option 3, Esau could have been impressed by Jacob's homage. All that bowing and scraping might have made him think, maybe I don't want to kill my brother after all. The NIV Study Bible speculates for option 4, that Esau had prospered so much, he lost the urge for revenge. In my humble opinion, that has a lot to do with it. I think that's why Esau had lost the urge for revenge. Remember, he was dirt poor, lost the blessing when he was mad at Jacob. Now he's made a bunch of money. When I say made money, he produced flocks, and he was wealthy now, and so he didn't worry so much about killing Jacob, I would think. We go down to Genesis 33, verses 5 through 7. "He lifted his eyes," that's Esau, "lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, 'Who are these with you?' So he," that's Jacob, "said, 'The children whom God has graciously given your servant.' Then the maids came near with their children," that's the first rank, "and they bowed down. Leah likewise came near with her children," that's the next rank, "and they bowed down. And afterward, Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down." That's assuming there are 3 divisions. Well, even if there's 4, the maids went first in 2 separate divisions. The maids go first, Leah second, and Rachel third. She's the most honored of the wives. Now, Esau was probably genuinely surprised by seeing all the women and the children, because Jacob had made no mention of his wives and children when he sent his messengers to Esau, as John Gill points out. Genesis 32, verse 5. This is what Jacob told the servants to tell Esau. "I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants. And I have sent to tell my Lord that I may find favor in your sight." He told Esau all about the oxen and the donkeys and the flocks of sheep and the male and the female servants, but he didn't say anything about his wives and children. Now, when Esau asked him about such, Jacob replied, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." Why did he mention the children only and not the wives? Well, John Gill speculates the reason he did that is because the children would be Esau's kin, Esau's nephews and one niece, Dinah, 11 nephews and one niece, Dinah, and so that's why he mentioned the children, because Esau would be more interested in the children than he would be in Jacob's wife. Or another option is what's the point of mentioning the mothers? Because if you mention children, that by implication means that there's mothers also. Jacob says that these children, he tells Esau that his children have been graciously given to his servant. And basically what he means is, I didn't do this. This was God that did it. My children are a gift of God. They are a product of the grace of God, not having anything to do with me. So Jacob, by this time, most people say, has become a little bit more spiritual than he was when he set out for Haran from Beersheba 20 years earlier. I should mention here that verse 7 mentions one of the children by name, Joseph, along with Rachel. Remember, Rachel only has one child of her own. Benjamin has not been born yet. She's going to die in childbirth with Benjamin between Bethel and Bethlehem later on in our story. But right now, she only has one child, Joseph, the youngest child so far. Now, notice that our text says that Joseph came near with Rachel and they bowed down, and Joseph is mentioned before Rachel. Well, some speculate that that means that Joseph went before Rachel, that Rachel kind of led him up to Esau first. If that's so, why? Well, John Gill speculates there's greater safety that way. She could keep an eye on him. That's generally what mothers would do. Or John Gill speculates that maybe Rachel is trying to teach Joseph how to do obeisance to Esau. The great Uncle Esau is here, so let's bow down to him. Let's be polite. And I have to make one point here. Notice that Joseph is mentioned before Rachel. Now, if I were a feminist, which thank God I'm not, but if I were a feminist, I would say, see there, Joseph has more authority over Rachel because he was mentioned first. You know, feminists love to say, well, you know, Priscilla had authority over Aquila, Priscilla being the wife and Aquila being the husband, because she's mentioned several times in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, first, before Aquila, Priscilla and Aquila, Priscilla and Aquila. Well, there's a couple of problems with that. First of all, I can find two places where Aquila is mentioned before Priscilla, and right here, Joseph is mentioned before Rachel. Are we going to say that little Joseph, who's about 6 years old now, has authority over his mother because he's mentioned first? I don't think so. Genesis 33, 8 through 11, and he, that's Esau, said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? And he, Jacob, said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. Jacob said, no, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. That's kind of interesting, as you see the face of God, and they thought that if you saw the face of God, you'd die. I'm sure that Jacob was trying to be polite to Esau here, but really, he's looking at Esau like the face of God. That means he might be thinking about dying, because Jacob was in a very bad position. He could very easily have gotten wiped out. 400 men against a couple of servants. He would have been clobbered. Verse 11, Jacob continues speaking to Esau. Please take my gift which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have plenty. Then Jacob urged Esau, and Esau took it. Took the gift, took the present. Remember, that was in a previous chapter where Jacob prepared three herds of cattle, sheep and such, camels, donkeys, milking camels and all that, and he presented them one after the other, kind of to run Esau over with his munificence and homage. And so that's what he's referring to. He says, take the gift which has been brought to you. You've already seen that. My servants brought all these gifts to you, so take the gift. I've got plenty. I don't need them. And Esau took it. Now in verse 8, Esau said, what do you mean by all this company which I've met? Esau, of course, knew that the flocks were meant as a present for him. All this procession is what the Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as. All this procession of flocks and animals and all this kind of stuff. The NIV says droves, which means basically herds of cattle. What do you mean by all this cattle and flock which I've met? Well, he knew that the flocks were meant as a present for him. Jacob's servants had already told him that. But he wanted to hear it from Jacob's own mouth. And Jacob makes no bones about it. He says, I want to find favor in the sight of my Lord. I'm trying to buy you off, Esau, to put it a little more bluntly. Esau responds very graciously. He says, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. Obviously, Esau is no longer a covetous man. Now, the interesting word about this word gift in verse 11, where Jacob says to Esau, please take my gift. That word is blessing. It's the exact same Hebrew word that's used in Genesis 27:35 for blessing. Genesis 27:35, and Isaac said to Esau, your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing. So Esau, and Jacob's father, says, Esau, Jacob robbed you of your blessing. Same word that's used here where Jacob says, please take my blessing, which has been brought to you, my gift, which has been brought to you. Now, what are the implications of that same word, of that word being the same? Well, first implication is Jacob was giving back the blessing he had stolen from Esau. So Esau was made whole. I don't know if he was totally made whole, but it certainly eased the wound a little bit. And note also in verse 11 that he says, here's my gift because God has dealt graciously with me. In other words, I'm being gracious to you, Esau, because God has been gracious with me. So Jacob is saying that the blessing he struggled for was from God, not him. God has been gracious to me. I didn't deserve this. I'm wounded in my flesh. God didn't deserve this, but I'm going to give it to you, not because you're paying me anything, just because I want to give it to you as a matter of grace. So Jacob is being very gracious here. Now, remember at Peniel, when Jacob wrestled the angel of the Lord, he was wrestling for blessing. He was saying, I'm not going to quit wrestling you, angel, until you give me a blessing. And he finally got the blessing. But as he was leaving, the angel of the Lord wounded Jacob in his hip. And the whole point of that was to show that, yes, you keep persisting in prayer and asking God for a blessing, he'll give it to you, but he's going to wound you in your flesh because it's going to be a matter of his grace that he gives you the blessing, not as a matter of what you've done to earn that blessing. Now, Jacob was very insistent upon Esau taking that gift. He said, verse 11 says, he urged Esau to take the gift. Now, why was Jacob so urgent about Esau accepting that gift? Because one necessarily becomes a friend of the one giving a gift. So if Esau took that gift, that he would be saying, he would be signaling to Jacob, I'm your friend now. I'm not your enemy. I'm not going to try to kill you anymore. As Adam Clark says, Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, in Esau's acceptance, he had the strongest proofs of a good feeling being established that Eastern notions admit of, which is a fancy way of saying it. Jacob would know that Esau was his friend. We go now to Genesis 33, verses 12 through 14. Then Esau said, let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you. But he said to him, Jacob said to Esau, my Lord knows that the children are frail, and the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me. And if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle that are before me and according to the pace of the children until I come to my Lord at Seir. Now in verse 12, Esau says, I will go before you. Now why? To show Jacob the way, to point out places of danger. As John Gill says, I will go before you and lead you on. But Jacob says, let's don't do that. My children are frail. The flocks and the herds are frail. They're nursing. The babies are nursing. And if I drive them to keep up with you, my flocks will die. Remember, Esau didn't come with flocks. He just came with 400 servants, but no flocks. This is a perfectly reasonable request. His children were frail also, not only his flocks. The oldest one was 13 years old. The youngest is about 6. So he says, no, you go on back. And then I will come to you at Seir. Now, Seir, of course, is Edom, which is southeast of the Dead Sea and further on south. Jacob never went to Seir. He ended up at Shechem, which is right across the River Jordan from where he is now at Peniel, about 10 miles or so, maybe 20, I don't know, not too far. So let's look at Jacob's intentions. What are our options as we try to discern Jacob's intentions? He wants to proceed at leisure, whereas he wants Esau to head on out and go back to Seir. First option is that Jacob had no intention of following Esau back to Seir. This is the NIV Study Bible's view. The scholars who wrote the note there said that Jacob was still the deceiver. He's deceiving Esau. Now, I have trouble believing that, honestly, after all this sweet talk between Esau and Jacob, and Jacob still trying to hoodoo his brother? No, I don't think so. He's talking about God's graciousness. He got wounded by the angel of the Lord at the river Jabbok at Peniel. I don't think so. I think that he was fully intending to go to Seir, but didn't go. His frail condition of his children and his flocks, he finally decided, I can't go down there in that rocky, desolate wasteland with my wife and kids and flocks. They're going to die down there. I think I'm going to go back to Shechem, which is a much more fertile place. So I don't think, of course I could be wrong, but I don't think that Jacob was trying to fool his brother Esau again. Now, why might Jacob might not have wanted to go? Why might Jacob not have wanted to go to Seir? Well, first of all, he could be worried about another flare-up with Esau. Jacob's spirit and character, of course, were much different than Esau's. James F. Fawcett Brown say that Jacob knew that an incident somewhere down the line would destroy their present harmony. Well, if that's the case, then Jacob is not really being a deceiver. He's just being polite. He's being politic, if you will. He's giving a reasonable excuse. Well, you know, before I go down to Seir, my wife and children are frail, my cattle are frail. And maybe he never intended to go to Seir. Maybe he didn't intend to fool Esau into thinking he would be going to Seir. Maybe Esau didn't believe he was trying to, that Jacob was thinking about going to Seir. I don't know. But it could be that Jacob is worried to go down there and live with his brother Esau because those two were not of the same character. This is a great example of how sometimes unity requires separation. Ironically enough, sometimes people just can't get along with each other and need to separate. I think of Paul and Barnabas, Paul and John Mark at the first missionary journey. Jesus withdrew from men knowing what was in their hearts. I don't have the site. It's in the Gospels. You recall he just left. He says Jesus knew what was in their hearts. He withdrew from the crowds. Well, having said all that, but we do need to note that Jacob and Esau did live in peace later in Canaan, Genesis 36:6. Then Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all his household and his livestock and all his cattle and all his goods, which he had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to another land away from his brother Jacob. So here we see in Genesis 36:6 that they apparently were peaceful together until things got crowded and then they separated in order to remain peaceful. We'll get to that when we get to Genesis 36:6. But anyway, getting back to our problem here of why Jacob might not have wanted to go down to Seir to Edom, to see Esau, to live with Esau, because he was scared they weren't going to get along. Maybe Jacob was still somewhat afraid of Esau. I don't know. I think the best explanation of Jacob's motives and intentions here is to say that he never intended to go to Seir because he intended to go to Seir, but he didn't go because of the frail condition of his children and his flocks, as John Gill suggests. We go to verse 15, Genesis 33. Esau said, "Please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, that's Jacob said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." Now, why would Esau want to be leaving some of his people, some of his servants with Jacob? Well, perhaps to show Jacob the way, to guard the road, to make Jacob appear more honorable when he entered into Seir might be another reason. But at any rate, he very graciously offered to leave him some servants. Now, if you are a little bit cynical, you might think, well, Esau might have been wanting to leave some servants with Jacob so they could keep their eyes on Jacob to make sure that Jacob didn't do something that would make Esau unhappy, to spy on Jacob, in other words. So I'm still not sure that Jacob was perfectly secure here. He says, no, there's no need for that. What need is there? Here's some options as to why Jacob didn't want the men, Esau's men, to stay with him, because he probably knew the way. Jacob, before he went to Seir, used to live in the area. He used to, lived a little bit west across the Jordan River, and he probably knew where he was going. And he probably didn't feel any danger. He just made a big peace with Esau. Now, of course, I just mentioned the possibility that he might not have wanted those men because he was afraid that Esau's men might have been spying on him and not dealing with him properly, but I really don't think so. They seem so reconciled at this point, but I do bring it up as a possibility. But at any rate, Jacob doesn't want those men. Now, this request is finished off here by Jacob. He says, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord," which is a little bit stilted. New American Standard Bible translation, the Holman Christian Standard Bible has it this way. "Why do that? Please indulge me, my Lord." In other words, please let me go without your service. Indulge me, Esau. We go to Genesis 33, verses 16 and 17. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. Remember, Seir is to the southeast of the southern tip of the Dead Sea in what later became known as Edom. The descendants of Esau were known as the Edomites. Jacob returned to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the place is named Succoth. Now, Succoth means shelters. If you look at the map, Mahanaim is right, maybe, 10 miles from the Jordan River, right on the edge of the Jabbok River. Peniel is right near Mahanaim. That's where Jacob was camped when he heard about Esau coming. And Peniel is where he wrestled with the angel of the Lord. Both of those places, if you go due west, you cross the Jordan. Well, you don't cross the Jordan River. You're going towards the Jordan River, and you enter into the Jordan River Valley, and you go about 5 miles, and you go to the place that is called Succoth here. Now, Succoth means shelters, and that's why they call it Succoth, because Jacob built a house there and made booths for his livestock, barns, if you will. Maybe not a barn's not a good word, sheds for his livestock. So the place is called Succoth. Now, Succoth is kind of an interesting place because it shows up in later Old Testament history. Let me read from Easton's Illustrated Dictionary. The princes of the city, Succoth, churlishly refused to afford help to Gideon and his 300 men. When faint yet pursuing, they followed one of the bands of the fugitive Midianites after the great victory at Gilboa. After overtaking and routing this band at Karkor, Gideon, on his return, visited the rulers of the city with severe punishment. This is Succoth we're talking about here. Gideon took the elders of the city of Succoth and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. That's King James for he whipped them. At this place were erected the foundries for casting the metalwork of the temple, as mentioned later in 1 Kings. Incidentally, it's an incidental detail. Now, the name there for Succoth is given in anticipation because there was no city there yet. It was just a place that was called Succoth. But afterwards, there was a city there, and it belonged to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and was given to Gad at the distribution of the land to the east of the Jordan River when Joshua distributed the land. Now, because Jacob is said to build a house at Succoth, it sounds like that Jacob was planning to settle down and stay a while, as Gill and Clark say. This is despite indicating to Esau that he was planning to go to Seir. Again, we debated on whether he really meant to go to Seir or whether he was just fooling Esau. But at any rate, he didn't go to Seir. He went to Succoth first on his way to Shechem. We go to Genesis 33, verse 18. Now, Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, and I emphasize that word safely. I'll show you why in just a minute. Now, Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram and camped before the city. Padan Aram, of course, is Syria. And where is Shechem? Well, if you go from Succoth directly straight west across the Jordan River Valley, across the Jordan River, you got to go through some hills. You go another 10, 15 miles or so, and you end up in Shechem, which is in the valley between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And the Shechem has a lot of history, so we're going to go through Shechem. Again, using Easton's dictionary, Shechem is a city in Samaria, also called Sichem. It stood in the narrow, sheltered valley between Ebal on the north and Gerizim on the south. And just quick, real quickly here, when Moses gave the law, Joshua was supposed to take the law and he was supposed to read the curses off of Mount Ebal on the north and the blessings off of Mount Gerizim in the south. In other words, if you keep this law, you're going to get blessed, as we hear from Mount Gerizim. If you don't keep the law, you're going to get cursed, as you hear from Ebal on the north. That's in Deuteronomy 28 and following. Those mountains were only some 500 yards apart at their base. All right, so Shechem is famous for the cursings and the blessings of the law, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim on either side of Shechem. Also here, Abraham pitched his tent, built his first altar in the promised land, and received the first divine promise that your descendants will be like the seeds, the dust of the earth. He was promised this as he was leaving Haran and Padan Aram in Syria, and that was the first place that Abraham landed when he ended up in the promised land. Now, of course, we just read about how Jacob brought some feet. Well, we read about how Jacob is leaving Succoth to go to Shechem. In just a minute, we'll read how he bought a parcel of field from the children of Hamor. We'll read that in just a minute, or maybe in our next audio, perhaps. Jacob dug a well there at Shechem. That was the same well that the famous woman at the well in Samaria. Jesus and the Samaritan woman, John chapter 4, it's the same well. And the NIV Study Bible has an interesting note. It says that well is still there today. Now, I traveled through Israel, but unfortunately Shechem is in the present. The city is still there, but it's called Nablus. It belongs to the Palestinians now. It's in the West Bank. And people on Israel tours cannot go to the West Bank very easily, and so we didn't get to see it. But that's kind of interesting. Well is still there. Joshua gave his second parting address there at Shechem, made a covenant with the people that day. The scripture says, we'll talk about that when we get there. A great stone was set up to memorialize this, set up under an oak, maybe that old oak of Moreh that Abraham was under when he first came to Shechem. So Joshua had some history there. Shechem later, under the law, became one of the six cities of refuge. Rehoboam was appointed king in the divine monarchy age. in Shechem. Jeroboam later took up his residence there at Shechem. That's enough. Let's just show you. There's a lot of stuff happening at Shechem, so you need to know where Shechem is and what it's famous for. Jacob is following in the footsteps of his grandfather Abraham. As I've already mentioned, Genesis 12:6, Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem to the Oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. So Shechem is where Abram first touched down in the Promised Land. There, Jacob's well was dug, as I said. I've already mentioned that. Now, here's a minor point here. The NIV note mentions this. Some manuscripts have, instead of Shechem, Shalem, S-H-A-L-E-M. Adam Clark says that this means that Abraham camped in peace. He didn't necessarily camp in Shechem. And Clark says that somewhere in the vicinity, there must have been a place called Shalem, not Shechem. Well, we're not going to worry about that. We're going to assume Shechem. Now, let's get back to this word safely. This is really the most important word in the verse here. Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem. Well, you know, you read that and you don't think, well, so what? He was safe because Esau didn't wipe him out. But it has some significance because, if you recall, when Jacob was at Bethel 20 years earlier on his way over to Haran in Padan Aram in Syria, he stopped at Bethel. And in Genesis 28:21, we read that Jacob said to the Lord, "If I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God." In other words, God, if you'll just show me that if I can come back here to the Promised Land, I'll worship you forever, Yahweh. And the word safety is used there in that promise that Jacob made to God at Bethel in Genesis 28:21. And if I return to my father's house in safety. And then, just very casually, the text here says, Jacob returned safely to Shechem. Ah, so now, assuming Jacob meant what he said at Bethel, Jacob now can say, Jacob now probably has said here 20 years later that since he has arrived safely to the city of Shechem, that now Yahweh is his God, which is a happy, happy, happy outcome of this story. Genesis 33, verse 19, we continue. He, Jacob, bought the piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Now, the piece of money is a kesetah, is the Hebrew, but this is a unit of unknown weight and value, so we don't know how much he paid for the land, not that it really matters. He has a piece of land there in Shechem, but Jacob's descendants, the patriarchs, they're going to inherit the whole land, because when Joshua comes in with the patriarchs, with Reuben and Simeon and Judah and Levi and all those guys, Issachar and Zebulun and Naphtali and Dan and all the patriarchs, they're going to get the whole land, all of it, not just a little piece. Now, Hamor is Shechem's father, so the place, I assume, was named after a guy named Shechem. We go down to verse 20, and we'll finish up this audio. Then he, Jacob, erected there at Shechem, he erected there an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Now, this altar has a name, El Elohe Israel. Here's some options as how to translate that. The NIV Study Bible gives two options. First option is, it means God, the God of Israel. Second option is, mighty is the God of Israel. The Holman Christian Study Bible takes the first option and translates it straight out. And he set up an altar there and called it God, the God of Israel. Then ASB punts and puts and just transliterates the Hebrew into English, El Elohe Israel, and doesn't translate it for us. But at any rate, we see here that Jacob is now acknowledging God as his father because he safely returned to Israel, just like he promised God in Genesis 28 when he was at Bethel. If I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. And there's an altar that says, God, the God of Israel, which is basically saying the same thing that, hey, God is, Yahweh is my God. I just previously expressed some doubt that maybe Jacob didn't mean what he was saying. I said, assuming he means what he was saying. And I think we need to assume that because he built an altar here. And so, again, that's a happy ending of that little sojourn in pagan land over there in Syria. So we have now finished Genesis chapter 33. That prepares us to go to our next audio, which is Genesis chapter 34, verses 1 through 31. We'll do the entire chapter. We will read the story of how Sister Dinah is raped by the Shechemites. Sad story. Hope you stay tuned for it, however, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.